Introducing Holger, I'd like to welcome Holger on stage. He's a Professor of Environmental Engineering at the School of Civil, Environmental and Mining Engineering at the University of Adelaide. His research is focused on developing improved techniques for the sustainable management of infrastructure and natural resources in an uncertain environment, and includes elements of modelling, optimisation and decision support. And he's currently the research leader of the Economics and Strategic Decisions Research Cluster of the Bushfire and Natural Hazards CRC. Welcome, Holger.
Thanks very much for having me today. So I'll, as Richard said, talk about a decision support system for long-term disaster risk reduction. So I'd like to start with this quote, which I really think sums it up really well. So tomorrow's risk is being built today as a first point, and then we must therefore move away from risk assessments that show risk at a single point in the present and move instead towards risk assessments that can guide decision makers towards a resilient future. So it touches on a number of points we've talked about today. But I think, you know, when I think about the people that the governments are working with around Australia, most people are looking at this first part, trying to actually map the current risk. And a lot of them are not struggling, but they're really, you know, getting onto it and getting a better handle of what's out there, producing these risk maps that we have. But then when we think about the future, that's where it gets a little bit more dicey. And I think, you know, as people are looking at climate change, for sure, but that seems to be the major driver of change people are looking at the moment. And as David said, it's the easiest stuff. You know, I mean, it's uncertain, but it's certainly, when you look at economics and technology disruptors, population growth, that's much harder to deal with, but they all have a really big impact. And when you think about the resilient future aspect, well, we're not really, you know, mitigation's talked about, but there's been a number of comments today about the fact that it's not politically very, you know, there's very little political capital in saying we're going to spend money on stuff so, you know, so that nothing will happen. It's much easier to say, look, you know, something's happened, we'll give you some money and, you know, pull on the heartstrings and make it happen. And at the same time also, when you talk about resilience and adaptation, it's about dynamism and the dynamic futures. And most of the assessments are done at a particular time slice, so 2100 or 2050. But when you're looking at adaptive pathways, we need a more dynamic view of how risk changes into the future. So I guess that's really what we've been trying to grapple with and develop a tool that pulls everything together and enables us to look at these different things. So I guess that leads to the idea of a policy wind tunnel. And so we think that, you know, this having a policy wind tunnel enables us to assess all of these different factors in an integrated way. And when you think about, you know, when people build a car or a, you know, they don't just build it and test it under one particular condition and then, you know, build it, mass produce it, send it out there, and all of a sudden the conditions the car's exposed to are different than what you thought. But most of the time with policies, we don't test them. We just think, oh, that's a good idea, let's do that, and then we, no, there's no beta testing, release it, and out it goes, and then 20 years later, go, oh, well, that didn't work so well. And so there are two aspects to the wind tunnel testing. There's the design bit, so how do you shape the aerodynamics of the car? And then there's the bit, you know, how do you stress test how well that works under a range of different conditions? And so in our case, we're looking at, you know, the design of the car is really how do you, what policies do you put in place to reduce this long-term risk? And then when you think about the wind exposure, that's really the conditions that are changing in the future. And so these are really the two elements I've talked about. When you talk about future risk, you've got these things you generally can't change, not at the local level. You know, things like climate change, we can change as a global community, but not, you know, as a local decision maker, you can't just change the climate. Similarly with population, that's something that usually happens at a larger level. The global economy is a driver, and then obviously technological disruption, you know, things like smart electric cars and that sort of thing. They're things that just happen and we have to deal with. So that's the wind, the different conditions we're exposed to. But then the design of the car is really the things we can control. So things people have mentioned already today, land use planning, land management like prescribed burning in terms of bushfires, building code changes, different structural measures like levees, dams, seawalls, that sort of thing, and community education. And so all of these things have been touched on today in various talks. I guess what we've tried to do is to pull everything together so you can look at it in an integrated fashion and explore all these different things together and then, you know, make transparent, informed decisions you can actually, a lot of the government agencies are grappling with this. How do we convince governments? You know, all the research says there are the benefit cost ratios, for mitigation stack up, but there's no evidence to support that. So this is an attempt to actually put some numbers to all of these things. So when you think about risk, now this is the risk triangle, and everybody talked about peril today, so hazard in my world is peril in your world by the look of things. So basically the idea is if you've got a particular location and we're talking about flooding, if it doesn't get wet, then there's no risk. If it does get wet, then you need to think about what actually is there that gets wet. Is anything there? If nothing's there, it doesn't matter. If there's a building there or people are there, that's the exposure side of things, then there is potentially some risk there. And then the last bit, the vulnerability, is really if something does get wet, how vulnerable is it to damage? Could be people, either elderly people, fragile people, or is the building hardened against flooding, or is there going to be a lot of damage? So that's really the idea of the risk triangle, having these three different components that add up to form the risk. And then when you think about all the bits that have been talked about, they form into these different, can be put into these different categories. So the hazard or the peril is really all the things we've talked about, in coastal inundation, flooding, earthquake, bushfire. They are the hazards we've looked at together, but because obviously cyclones are another hazard that we can talk about and all sorts of different things. Exposure are the things that are exposed to the hazard or the peril. That's the land, the people, the economy, all the things we care about, the things that have value. And then the vulnerability is the social capital, the social vulnerability, building stock, building vulnerability, all these different things. And then you think about how they change over time. Well, there's a myriad of things, that affect that. And so as David talked about, climate affects a number of these hazards. It doesn't affect earthquake, but obviously the other ones it does. Bushfire, coastal inundation, flooding are all affected. Cyclones are all affected by climate. Exposure is affected by population growth. If you've got, areas are growing, Sydney is growing, Melbourne is growing, so you're going to have, people in more exposed areas. And that's really, the biggest growth occurs in these corridors where you've got bushfire and flood risks, because all the other areas are taken up already. And then you've got vulnerability. We've got an ageing population. People have talked about that. The building stock is changing. What are we doing about that? There could be new materials in the future that could be combustion proof. There are some already, but all these different things can change into the future. All right. So the way to conceptualize this, and that's, again, the Sarah's talk this morning put that quite nicely with the vulnerability curves and everything, and Daniel talked about the vulnerability models as well. It's the same sort of idea. So where, for example, if you've got an inundation, if you look over here, you've got this is the Melbourne model we've got, but this is the coastal inundation. So on the hazard side of things, you've got a particular scenario, a particular climate scenario, shows you the inundation level in our model. In terms of exposure, we've got land use here. Oops, that's disappeared. That wasn't so good. I'll get that back. Okay. Oh, there we go. So in terms of land use, we've got sort of a land use map in this particular case. And then you've got a building stock model, or you can have social vulnerability models that can sort of show you what's actually exposed to the hazard. And then you've got the damage curves. It could be a simple curve like this, or it could be a more complicated model that gives you the relationship between the level of inundation in this case and the corresponding damage. So that's all good, but when you talk about time and dynamics, so the idea is we don't just have maps of these things, we've got models. And so when you've got a model, you can actually see what happens in the future under different scenarios and conditions. So the idea is not to forecast or predict the future, it's to explore the future under different plausible futures, different combinations of climate, population growth, different risk reduction strategies. What would that look like? And so, for example, in the land use, we've got a cellular automata model that looks at things like behavioural attraction between different types of land uses, repulsion attraction between residential, commercial, industrial. You've got things like all the infrastructures in there that has an impact. If you build a railway station somewhere, it's going to attract people in the future to live nearby. You've got the suitability of land, what's the actual what are the physical attributes of that land, and finally the whole planning side of things. Do you actually allow people to build there or restrict that? Do you encourage growth or do you prohibit it? And so the model works by having a demand for population and other socioeconomic drivers, and then you can basically look at how where things are, how land use is changing. And then we hook that up with a building stock model. Then it gives you the land value. And then on the inundation side, we've got various hazard or peril models. And then you've got the vulnerability curves for the different hazards as well. And then just to give you a little demonstration of how things might change over time, you can, you know, as there's population growth, so with the different particular climate change scenario, inundation levels change with land use, the, you know, the population growth, the value of the building stock changes, and that changes the overall risk over time. So this keeps cycling through, the time's not updating, but you can see that's sort of the idea that these models, for example, at 100 by 100 metre raster cell, annual updates, so that's sort of how it works. Okay, so we've done this in four different states. So as part of the CRC project, initially three states signed up. So we've got Greater Adelaide, we've got Greater and Peri-Urban Melbourne, and we've got all of Tasmania. And the nice thing was that once the people in WA saw the model, they said, we want one, and so they've put up the money to develop one in Perth as well. So that's sort of happening at the moment. And again, as I said, the idea is not to have a bit of software to sort of give to people. It's a whole participatory process where we start with policy context, understanding, you know, what are the numbers you need to use to convince your minister to give you some money or treasury, and then use that to actually develop the indicators that you need, the types of hazards you want, the mitigation options you want, and then we develop the model around that and then work with governments to run scenarios and then go through that loop of developing and then testing the model. And again, the idea is really that idea of transparency, defensibility of making decisions. You know, when you're spending money on mitigation, it's usually the idea of where do you spend it, when do you spend it, how do you justify that, what's the benefit-cost ratio, and that's really what comes out of the model, both the spatial and temporal aspects of that. The other thing, it's really a good communication device. You know, when you've got different agencies talking, sitting around the table, you know, the planners and the, you know, the people who are responsible for the various hazards, you know, they can deal with the same data, the same information, the same overlays, and actually explore, okay, if I do this, then what's the impact going to be? So, for example, you're trying to reduce the risk of coastal inundation, and you might sort of explore, do I put a seawall in or do I retreat? And you might say, okay, well, you know, the seawall is not going to work, we're going to retreat. But the city is going to grow, so the people have to go somewhere. So where are they going to go? Oh, well, they might go to the hills, that's a nice spot. Well, there's bushfire risk. Oh, well, let's try and increase population density. You're going to have urban heat island effects and more people are going to die because of that. So if you look at one hazard at a time, you know, you might miss all that interaction and interplay. And particularly with flooding, when you've got, usually it's local councils dealing with it, and you get very interesting interactions there. So if you've got the same sort of tool, people sitting around the table exploring things together, it really helps you understand and share that risk in a much better way. So just a very, very systems diagram of the model. It's deliberately very modular. So you've got different bits and pieces, and the idea is not that we've got perfect models. The idea is that you can actually change and update this over time as better models become available, better data become available. I do have to speed up a little bit because of the 5 minutes. So there's some examples of what you can do, just give you a bit of a feel. So you don't have to use the full shebang. You can just look at the hazards. So for example, for Adelaide, we've got sort of the Port Adelaide area. You can look at sea level rise now, or you can then look at an RCP 8.5, and you can look at the different inundation levels, for example. Flooding, Brownhill Keswick Creek area, you can look at the, you know, what the riverine flooding is in a 100-year event. Without levee banks, you can stick in the levee banks, and you can see what the impact is, just looking at the hazard, if that's what you're interested in. Exposure and vulnerability, that's the land use model for Adelaide under a particular scenario. That's a particular, you know, socioeconomic population growth scenario. It's changing year by year. It's very hard to pick up. As you can see, from 2050, it goes back to 2015. So you can see the different land use changes, and that sort of changes where assets are, where people are, where things of value are, and how that changes over time. You can look at then change maps before and after. Green being nothing's changed, blue being there's extra stuff there, that's the rural residential. Working with the Gawler Council, there's six councils up to the north of Adelaide. They had a $50 million worth of damage about a couple of years ago with a flood event. And they had some consultants do some 2D hydrodynamic modelling of the flooding under, you know, putting in a floodway or increasing the dam height. And so we put that into the model, and then we've looked at the probability of urbanisation. So the red colours are really probabilities of urbanisation. We ran our model stochastically, 1,000 different sort of scenarios. Because of the behavioural aspect in the model, it's not deterministic where growth will occur. And you can see, look, where are people likely to live in the 100-year floodplain or not? And then you can explore. You say, look, if we prevent people from building there, where are they going to go? What other things can we do? Do we change the building codes? What's that going to cost? What's the benefit-cost ratio of doing that? Land use planning versus structural measures versus other bits and pieces that you want to explore. Risk, that's the... So that's the earthquake stuff for Adelaide. Again, it's changing over time because of population growth. The hazard's fixed. The earthquake's not really changing over time. But again, you can look at that very quickly. Heatwave, we've done some work on heatwave. I've taken off the numbers because it's a scenario just to make sure nobody quotes me on this. But again, this is the sort of thing you can do. Look at both the changes in excess heat factor over time based on daily time series with under different climate projections and population growth. Bushfire, again, you can see how bushfire risk changes dynamically with the bushfire model we've got in there and the population changes. Then you can look at retrofit. So there's a bunch of projects in the CRC looking at building hardening. So, for example, looking at earthquake retrofitting, you can then change the vulnerability curve in the model based on the output of that research. Again, you can look at how does the risk change if we actually spend money on retrofitting buildings in a particular area at a particular time. Same with prescribed burning. You can see the veg map in the green at the bottom right-hand corner. If you basically knock out some of the vegetation through prescribed burning, it reduces the risk and then it grows back over time and the risk changes dynamically. Finally, integrated stuff. So you can put it all together so you can answer questions like what's the impact of different climate change coupled with different population projections, different mitigation strategies, different hazards all together. What's the relative importance of different drivers, different mitigation strategies, different hazards? So looking at sensitivities around that. Benefit-cost ratios of mitigation strategies. Best portfolio for a given budget, so there's optimization in there. If you've got a fixed budget and say, look, what's the best mix of different things we can come up with? You can get that out of there. Future tipping points because of the dynamics. Just one final example of what we actually did. So in South Australia, we developed scenarios with a state mitigation advisory group, sort of got them all together and think about, from now till 2050 around different future worlds. And that's coming back to the idea that Rachel talked about a bit about, state-driven and locally-driven. So we had sort of scenarios developed around, not around the physical drivers, but around the policy options, things you can actually do something about. And so there were things... a world where there's higher future community resilience, so locally driven action, and a world where there's high dependence on top-down mitigation from the government and all the different combinations. And there are storylines that go with each of those. They're like 1.5-page narratives that describe a particular future world that's plausible. We're not saying it's likely, but it's plausible. So, for example, the ignorance of the lambs is the high dependence on government. So it's high immigration driven by refugees, so people are low economic, socioeconomic status, not very well off, likely to live in the outskirts of the city. The housing stock is probably quite poor. You've got long travel time, commute times to work, so there's not much time for community building. And because of different cultural backgrounds and a lack of understanding of the place they're living in, there's also not much community connection. So that's just one of the storylines. And then we basically, you can see all the different factors we considered, population, economy, blah, 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 on the left-hand side there. And, different dials for each of those. We quantified them based on strategic plans and then ran them through the model. And then you can get sort of outputs like these are the different land use changes, for example, and the three of the different scenarios, quite different. And so the risk profile will be very different under these different population scenarios, for example. Bushfire risk is quite different as well. And then social vulnerability, we did some work on that last year with an honours group. Again, you can look at some of those changes under these different future worlds, plausible future worlds. So to wrap up, basically what we try to do is to give people a chance to look at all these things that we talk about in an integrated fashion. Just to explore, we're not saying these are the accurate predictions, it's just a way of exploring different things. You can add in better information, better models over time. But it gives you a way of actually understanding the linkages and the connections and looking at everything together. So we've got dynamics and uncertainties, we've got exposure, hazard, intensity, likelihood, building vulnerability in there, multiple hazards and multiple risk reduction options that you can play around with. So thank you very much. And there's some acknowledgements of all the people who've contributed with that work. Thank you.